This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Now and then you'll read a news story about a business executive, journalist, or aid worker being kidnapped in a third world country. But our guest, journalist Nicholas Schmidl, says such kidnappings occur thousands of times every year. It's become so common, in fact, that an industry of insurance specialists and kidnapping and ransom consultants has grown up to service companies whose employees are seized by rebel groups or criminals looking for a payday. In a piece in the New York Times Sunday Magazine, Schmidl notes that kidnapping consultants have made bargaining, ransom, and the release of hostages almost routine. Some people wonder whether their willingness to negotiate and pay only makes the problem worse. Nicholas Schmidl is a fellow at the New America Foundation and a frequent contributor to the Times Magazine. He's also written a book about his experience living and reporting in Pakistan. It's called To Live or to Perish Forever, Two Tumultuous Years in Pakistan. Schmidl spoke to Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies.
Well, Nicholas Schmidl, welcome to Fresh Air. Your story in this week's New York Times Magazine begins with a Scottish gentleman who's a veteran worker in the oil industry at a karaoke bar in Nigeria when a bunch of armed men storm through the door, order everyone to the floor, and he is whisked away in a van and becomes a victim of kidnapping. Now, were the motives of his kidnappers financial or political or both?
A little bit of both. When John was kidnapped, at first he thought that these people that had bartered to the door were armed robbers. That was the most common form of crime that would happen in such an establishment. So they all told him to get down, and all these people are laying on the floor. And as they started combing through the crowd, there were, you know, no one knows exactly how many gunmen, maybe 8, maybe 12, because there were some that were also out in the vans waiting outside. As they were combing through the crowd, they started, some of them were picking out, taking watches off of those that were lying on the ground, while the others were talking purely political rhetoric and talking about what they were doing and, you know, wanting to know who people were. But John said that what let him know that these people were different was the way that they were pushing them into the van and that they were very careful. They realized that these people were commodities. And they realized that the people that they were about to kidnap were going to be used as political pawns, and they were also, in the end, also going to be used as financial pawns, and they needed them to be in as good of a shape and as unharmed as possible.
Now, your story really is about some of the financial superstructure that has developed around the industry of kidnapping and ransom. Speaking internationally, how common is this? I mean, are there scores, hundreds, thousands every year?
There are certainly thousands. There were last year in Mexico alone, there were 7,000 cases, reported cases of kidnapping. In Nigeria last year, there were about 450. And you know, so Mexico is by far and away the industry leader, if you will.
Of these thousands of kidnappings, does anybody have an estimate of how many are ideologically motivated or how many of them are simply cash transactions?
It increasingly is purely a business transaction. Now, in different countries, the nature of the kidnappings differs. In Nigeria, very few instances involve the victims being hurt or killed. In Mexico, there are reports that, you know, once someone is taken, fingers start getting cut off if the ransoms aren't paid in due time. And it's a much, much, much different different industry, if you will, a different business. So Nigeria, though, it really is all about the dollars. And particularly in the case of the foreign oil workers, I mean, John was telling me this, the Scottish guy was telling me these great stories, you know, of them once they were in the camp, once they had been kidnapped and were taken into the creeks and were being held at this camp where the kidnappers were, you know, they were ordering them takeout and they were then asking them what they wanted on their hamburgers and then they were getting in the boats and driving into the middle of Port Harcourt with a takeout order, ordering the takeout, throwing it in the bag, getting back in the boats and then driving back to the creeks to make sure that their 6 foreign hostages were happy and, you know, were relatively well-nourished.
Now, you write about the institutions that have grown up around these increasing numbers of kidnappings for ransom. There are, of course, insurance companies that write policies for firms that have employees at risk. And then there are these kidnapping and ransom consultants. What do they do?
The kidnapping ransom consultants are essentially advisors. So if a company, say Acme Company, wants to buy a kidnapping and ransom insurance policy, they will go to an insurance company, they will buy the policy, and then with that policy will come the stipulation that you are going to get a kidnapping and ransom consultant that should there be, he or she is not only going to advise on the front end about how to prevent kidnappings, but in the instance or the event of a kidnapping, will be on the scene with you, advising you and walking you through the negotiation process.
So it's to effectively negotiate release in a fiscally responsible manner?
Exactly. The biggest thing that these K&R consultants bring is they bring a world of historical and institutional knowledge. They know what an American who works for an oil company, what the ransom is in Nigeria, how that differs from, say, a Canadian journalist who's been kidnapped in Somalia, and how that differs from a British executive who's kidnapped in India or something. I mean, they draft what's called a target settlement figure. And that is essentially the K&R consultant's operating budget, how long they think it'll take, how much they think the ransoms will be, how much it's going to cost them to stay. So the policies cover everything. They're reimbursable policies. Now, the media also plays a major role. And one of these K&R consultants who'd spent a lot of time doing cases off the coast of piracy cases in Somalia said, look, CNN always gets the ransoms wrong. So these pirates come to us and they say, look, we saw the last ransom that was paid for a boat down in the Gulf of Aden or something. And CNN says they paid $10 million. And this guy, said, well, CNN's always wrong. It was, in fact, closer to $1 million. And so we can sort of revise the whole negotiation.
Hmm. Now, to what extent from your reporting do the police seriously try and investigate kidnappings or prevent them? Or to what extent are they in collusion with the kidnappers?
According to the police, it's pure investigation, no collusion whatsoever. According to the kidnappers and according to the local journalists and according to human rights lawyers, they depend upon one another. Idi Ali Nwezi, who was one of the most wanted kidnappers in Port Harcourt this spring, we had numerous meetings with this guy over the phone, in person, and he and his lawyer detailed the extent to which Idi Ali, after he would get a ransom, he would then pay back the police chief. He would give the police chief cars. He would give the police chief money. And in other cases, they would sort of alert the police ahead of time to, look, we're gonna do this kidnapping on this street at this time. Stay off the roads. So the relationship is frighteningly scary.
So a kidnapper told you directly, I was working with the police chief. He would clear the roads when I needed them, and he got his cut.
He went one step further. He said that the police chief's wife was, in fact, driving a car that I had bought with ransom money and donated to the police chief as a way of saying thank you.
Did you get back to the police chief and ask him about this?
Yes, I did. I talked to him a few weeks ago, and he said that it was a factual impossibility.
Tell us what happened to John, the guy that you wrote about who was kidnapped in Nigeria and taken away to this camp and given takeout orders by his captors.
Right. So John, the first morning that John woke up in the camp, he noticed that he gets into the camp on the first night, and they go through and they ask. The kidnappers didn't know who they had. They knew they had pulled six people off the ground in a bar. They didn't know who they had, so they went through and all of these guys named gave their name, their company affiliation, and their nationality. They went to sleep that night. The next morning they woke up, and the kidnappers that had brought in all this local labor, and they were putting together huts, and they were, they were cooking food. And John was saying that there are all these rumors and all these suspicions that cannibalism takes place back in these creeks. And John said, look, I don't know, and I don't know whether these guys were just trying to mess with us or get us into our head, but he was sitting on a bench in the camp one day. And one of the kidnappers next to him looked at John and he said, Oibo. And Oibo is the word in Nigeria for white man. And he said, Oibo. And he looked at John and he kind of scanned him and looked him up and down. And he said, good chop, good chop. And chop is the word for food and sort of in the pidgin English they speak, suggesting that, white men make particularly good food. So this went on for about 9 days. And on the ninth day, John was told to put on the kidnappers, the leader of the kidnapping gang in this camp came up to John and said, put on these clothes. And he handed him a ski mask, gloves, hat, camouflage pants, etc. He put all the gear on, and by this point he looked just like the rest of the kidnappers. And they got into a speedboat and they went racing off. And they drove for about 15 minutes in the water, in the river, and they eventually landed at a spit of sand. And there were three guys sitting on the beach. One of them handed John a phone and said, "John, we're gonna make a call right now, and you're gonna be asked two proof of life questions." And the proof of life is really the crux of the negotiation. And that is when the kidnappers and the negotiators can prove that the deal is on, and this is the last step, essentially. And so John was asked two questions about where he lived and in 1986 and what company he worked for. He answered both questions correctly. After the proof of life questions, they put the ski mask back on and they took off back down the river. John didn't know what this meant. They said, "Okay, the negotiations are going well. Just hold tight." Sure enough, that night, the captors went to the six hostages and told them to get ready. That they were planning the rendezvous. They were planning the money drop. And now if all went to plan, it was going to be simply a financial transaction. They were going to throw the hostages into the boats. They were going to take them to a landing in Port Harcourt. The hostages were going to get out, and they were going to be given a bag of money, and everyone was going to go on their merry ways. But just to make sure, the captors prepared as if they were going to war. Now, these are all people from the Ija community, and so they believe in the Ija god of war. His name is Igbesu. And so in order to honor Igbesu, they paint their face with white paint. They put red ribbons around their arms, and they all douse themselves as they're getting into the boats with a concoction that's based with a palm oil concoction. And all of the gunmen are getting droplets of this on their bodies. They're going in, stepping into the boat, and John steps into the boat and looks at the man standing there with a bucket and a little stick that he's using to spray everyone. And John says, "Well, what is that?" And he explains that this is a potion they believe that keeps bullets away and makes you immune from bullets. And John's got a really dry sense of humor, and he says, "Can we get some?" the guy says, "Yeah, sure." And so they go ahead and they douse the six hostages. And John says, "What happens? What if it doesn't work? What if we get a bullet?" And the guy looks at him and says, "Well, if you get hit and you start bleeding, then it means you just didn't believe properly." And so, within an hour or two, they got to the rendezvous point. There were no guns were fired except just in the air as the kidnappers were sort of trying to prevent any funny business at the last minute. So as the hostages were getting out of the boat and climbing up onto this landing and running to this land cruiser that was waiting a few hundred yards away, the kidnappers are firing up in the air just to create a sense of chaos. And that was it. So then John, that was John's 10-day spell as a hostage.
Do you know what it cost to get him back, what the ransom was?
According to him, there were two ransoms paid. Apparently the first ransom was about $300,000, but it had, quote-unquote, gone missing. And the second ransom, which actually resulted in their freedom, was another $300,000.
Do you know what he meant by gone missing?
The suggestion was that there was corruption involved and that, like I said, $300,000 had been sanctioned by someone. This was in the early days, so this could have actually been sanctioned by the insurance company. And then the Nigerian government could have said, "We don't know what happened to the money that you gave us yesterday." Or it could have been sanctioned by the Nigerian federal government, and the state government could have said, "We don't know what happened to the money that happened yesterday." But all told, approximately $600,000 were paid out.
I can imagine if I had a relative in a foreign country who was kidnapped, I would be hysterical. I would imagine that relatives may want to fly to the capital and get deeply involved. How do the consultants deal with family members? Do they tell them to stay away? Do they have techniques for calming them?
That's a great question. The consultancies, particularly the bigger consultancies that have multiple consultants working each case, will oftentimes have a consultant, say, back in Houston, Texas, that's working with that is keeping both headquarters in Houston, Texas, and keeping also the family calm. And then they'll also have another consultant who's say in Lagos, Nigeria, or Port Harcourt, who's working the case, working the negotiation side of it a little bit closer. It is a concern, and as one of the consultants said to me, it's when the gunshots go off in the background on the phone, and that's their way. I mean, in Somalia, the gunshots will go off, and that's the equivalent of say the Mexicans cutting someone's fingers off. He said that's gut check time, and that's when you as a consultant have to be able to keep everyone calm. And I don't think there were any secret techniques, or at least none that they shared with me. But that's the balance is keeping everyone's emotions in check. And remembering that while this is a life that we're trying to get out, you have to boil down that life to being a commodity, and you have to be realize that you're bartering for, you know, you're just bartering for a commodity.
You mentioned that you spent some time with this veteran kidnapper in Nigeria. How did you make that kind of contact?
Well, so this guy's name is Adeyele Nwezi, and he had become, according to the police chief in Port Harcourt, the main city where we were spending most of our time, he'd become the most wanted kidnapper in March and April. He'd been on the run from the government. He had, been hiding. No one knew where he was. And then in early August, the Nigerian government announced an amnesty for militants that had been fighting against the government in the Niger Delta region over the past several years. And the first people to enter this amnesty, embrace this amnesty, and turn in their weapons and declare that they sort of wanted to take the true path were oftentimes just simply criminals, such as my friend Adeyele Nwezi. He, about 10 days after the amnesty began, he went to the government and said, okay, you know, I'm ready to come in, but I want to be assured that I'm not going to be killed or prosecuted. And so this was the arrangement. Now, he was being held in a but he was also very angry. He was angry. He said that the terms of the amnesty hadn't been met. He wasn't getting the stipend that he had promised him, and that he still they promised to rebuild his house, and it was still laying and totally destroyed. So he was willing to talk, and we my fixer was a fantastic guy, and he'd been able to get in touch with him. And we went to a military safe house one afternoon, and the military oddly let us sit there and interview this guy for an hour. And he told us all about how he got into the industry, what he'd been, you know, who he'd kidnapped, how he'd kidnapped them, the kind of money he'd made, what he did with the money. And it was just – it was an amazing story. And you realize the extent to which this has become institutionalized, because his lawyer who was standing next to him, and his lawyer's name was, no joke, Innocent. And so as Innocent is standing there sort of watching the discussion, you know, Innocent is saying, you know, I would advise you not to go into detail on that or not to say that. And I thought, this is unreal. And so Innocent is like, you know, the kidnapper's lawyer. And it was really – it was quite a scene.
You also spoke to a young kidnapper who maybe in the lower end of the trade. His name was Didan, right?
That's exactly. He wanted to be called – that was his nom de guerre. He said, you know, call me Didan.
And how was his tale different?
His tale was different in that he wasn't as ruthless. He had a college degree. He had just graduated with a degree in political science a couple of years earlier. He told me that his favorite book was Machiavelli's The Prince. But there are cults on Nigerian campuses, and he belonged to this cult called the Greenlanders. And Didan, after he graduated, couldn't find a job as a political scientist and went back to his alumni network. And a couple of these Greenlanders were living in a camp, and they had been involved in kidnappings. And one thing led to another, and before Didan knew it, there were no options, and he and his buddies had formed a kidnapping syndicate and were running around kidnapping people, including 7-year-old kids.
But at a lower level, right? I mean, he didn't do Westerners, right?
And he didn't do Westerners, but he never had the chance, and he just didn't have the sophistication. He admitted. He said, you know, that we know that Westerners, and he said, you know, we know that white men are where the money is. So he was focusing on easy prey, older men that came from landed money, kids that they could easily grab and then be able to ransom off. And, you know, and he said that the ransoms that they received were in the tens of thousands, nothing, you know, like the hundreds of thousands of dollars that Nwezi was making.
Were there ways that you took special precautions, given what you learned about this issue when you were abroad and reporting it?
Well, over the course of the 2 years that I lived in Pakistan, where toward the end of my stay in late 2007, kidnapping was becoming a concern, and then I went back to Pakistan for a few weeks to do a reporting in August of 2008, and became more of a concern, particularly when stories started appearing in the press that I had been kidnapped when I actually hadn't been kidnapped. I kind of leave a paper trail, and we'll try and notify both family and stay very in close contact with editors. And on this trip, I was in contact every day with my editor, sending him a text message or an email right around 8 or 9 p.m. Nigerian time, as I was sort of turning in for the day and I was at my hotel, saying my location, the time, you know, how everything was going, etc. And at least that way, should something go wrong, everyone, you know, your last location is known much more accurately than just kind of disappearing for 3 weeks to go report a story.
Nicholas Schmidl, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me on, Dave.
Nicholas Schmidl spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. Schmidl's article on the kidnapping and ransom industry was published in this week's New York Times Sunday Magazine. Dave Davies is a senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.